Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, I talk with Jason Robert Brown. Peter, Michael, and I also chat with Sean McDermott. Shows reviewed are All the Way, Antony and Cleopatra, The Open House, Anyone Could Whistle, and Nothing But Trash. So please stay tuned.
My first crush on an Irish girl, I was 10 years old, and her name was Elaine. Little redhead girl, well, she looked like you, but if you were 10, which you're clearly not, not that you look old, but you get my... I'll just stop now. Okay, wait, because I had a point. No, I swear I did. Well, I think I did, which is all my life. For since I was 10, I have had a yen for an Irish lass. Because God knows why, like the ancient curse of the Shiksa queens. Do I talk too much? Which is not to say that I'd want Elaine, who turned out to be, when I last checked in, a Republican and a parapsychologist. If you've got a four-leaf clover, you can make my dreams come true. I will be your Hebrew slave, just do the things that Irish girls do. Talk about potato famine, I begin to cry on cue. Sing about the Emerald Isle and get your Irish eyes to smile, and I could be in love with someone like
you. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 16, 2014. My name is James Marino, and the broadcast this morning is Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
During the week this week, I got a chance to speak with Jason Robert Brown one-on-one. So let me play that for you right now. So with us, we have Jason Robert Brown, the acclaimed... writer of great musicals such as The Last 5 Years, such as Parade and The Bridges of Madison County recently, and the forthcoming Honeymoon in Vegas. Jason, thanks for taking time out of your schedule. I know you're incredibly busy.
Well, thank you, James. Happy to be here.
Oh, thanks. So tell us, you know, how do you do what you do? The with Bridges coming up, Bridges actually just passing, and Honeymoon in Vegas is taking up a lot of your time. What is on your agenda? I see that you have lots of appearances outside of those two shows that I just mentioned.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about that question is that right now, Bridges and Honeymoon are both sort of done. And you know, Bridges has been done,
yeah,
you know, obviously, literally since, you know, we opened. And Honeymoon in Vegas, you know, I've been writing it for 10 years. So, you know, we're largely out of the woods on that. So neither of them is occupying a lot of my actual writing time these days. But of course, they're the things that are being put out into the world. So I have to spend a lot of time talking about them and taking care of them and paying attention to them. You know, as far as my writing life, I'm starting on a couple of new projects that have had to kind of wait to get rolling until all of this stuff was out of the way. The concerts and appearances are things that I love doing, and honestly, I wasn't able to do for most of the last year, because between the revival of The Last 5 Years and then the Williamstown production of Bridges of Madison County and the movie of The Last 5 Years and the paper mill production of Honeymoon in Vegas and then the Broadway production of Bridges, I've been in rehearsal for pretty much the last 14 months nonstop. And so I haven't really been able to do any of the concerts or do any of the appearances, which is stuff I love to do, and also stuff that I sort of, it's part of my, you know, it's part of how I get the bills paid and part of how I meet the people who I work with. And, you know, it's all very important to me. So this month is jam-packed with a lot of different things. This weekend I'll be conducting an orchestra in Washington, D.C. that's doing a production of Songs for a New World. And then I've got lots of classes. I'm going to Michigan, and then I'm teaching at Harvard this semester. And so I've got a lot of that stuff going on. So, you know, a day in the life of me is a pretty complicated experience, but the fruits of it only come out occasionally. You know, certainly since 13 was 6 years ago, and, you know, Bridges is now the first new show I've had in New York since then. So sometimes I have to wait a long time for everyone to see what I've been up to.
So I see that you have up in your schedule coming up, you're doing an interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, it's tonight, and unfortunately, it's not with Lynn. It's with Stephen Pasquale. Not that
that's not unfortunate. But, yeah.
but Lynn had to bail out because he had to do a writing gig. So I'll be with Steve tonight, and we'll be chatting about. You know, he said he's going to get all James Lipton on my ass, so we'll see what happens.
And you know, on his night off, he's got to spend it with you.
I wouldn't have asked him to do it. Geez, the poor guy. He's got, you know, one night where he doesn't have to be all about me, and there he is. So, God bless him.
Coming up, you have the Honeymoon in Vegas preview concert at 54 Below. We hear that we talked with to Rob a few weeks ago, and he said it's the waiting for a theater show at 54 Below.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's true. I think the actors were getting bananas, you know, that they were all like, we love this show so much, we just want to do it, and how come we can't? And, you know, I would love them to do it too, but, you know, there's no place to put it at the moment. So they all had the idea that they should just go ahead and, you know, take over 54 Below one night. So we said, sure, go ahead. A chance for everyone to get to hear the songs.
I remember about 18 months, maybe 2 years ago, I got a copy of The Trumpet of the Swan in the mail from one of your record labels that put it out. And I thought it was such a dramatic change in the stuff that I've heard from you before. Tell me a little bit about Trumpet.
Oh, we love Trumpet of the Swan. You know, Marcia had gotten a commission from the Kennedy Center to do, an orchestral piece for kids, you know, something like a large-scale Peter and the Wolf. And she had asked me, and it sounded like exactly the kind of thing I wanted to do, and it would be so much fun. So, you know, I read the novel, which I just loved and hadn't ever read before. Apparently, a lot of musicians know it. You know, their dad and mom had read it to them when they were kids, but I had never heard it. So I loved it, and then working with Marcia was a dream. But I wrote it. We opened 13 on Broadway on, like, October 4th, I think, and then the premiere of Trumpet of the Swan was on December 5th. And that's all the time I had, because getting 13 up and running was so exhausting and so difficult that I only had from the day that the day after we opened, I could start writing Trumpet of the Swan. So I've never written as quickly in my entire life. And I was just sort of racing through it. So I had about 6 weeks of writing time, and then I had another 2 weeks to work on the orchestrations with Sam Davis. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience, and we had great musicians. Both times we did it at the Kennedy Center, we had great musicians, and we got to do it. The first time out, it was with Richard Thomas, who was just wonderful, and then he wasn't available for the second one, and John Lithgow came in, who was sensational. And so Lithgow and I did the album together with Jimmy Naughton and Marty Short and just these great, 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 great people. And, you know, every day of it was a miracle. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I'm going to conduct it in Beverly Hills in May. We're doing it at the Wallace. And then I hope we manage to get it to New York somehow. You know, it seems a shame that it hasn't been done here, but none of the appropriate organizations have stepped up yet. But I think there's a way to get it done here, and it's just such a great piece.
So Beautiful on Broadway is a big hit, and it talks about the story of a husband and wife team that are composers, and we think of our contemporaries, Bobby and Kristen Lopez, and perhaps you and Georgia. Have you guys ever written anything together that is out there?
No, we don't really write together. We did an orchestral piece last year called Waiting for Wings, which was a commission from the Cincinnati Pops. And there's a recording of that that'll actually be coming out this fall, I think. And that was great, and it was a lot of fun, but it's hard for us working together. And, you know, I think we both respect each other's work so much, and we love each other so much that it gets very hard to get in the weeds of, well, I don't know about that, or maybe we don't have to do it that way. You know, we've got two kids to raise and, you know, a life to live. There's enough to fight about and get crazy about. So we sort of, for a long time, we had a rule that we weren't going to write together because it was just too much and it was too hard, and we figured we'd rather be married. But I don't know how ironclad that is now, but it would have to really be the right thing. And it would just have to be, you know, it would have to be something we were both deeply, deeply passionate about.
So you mentioned that you have two kids to raise, but also it seems as though you are you are raising a whole generation of musical theater performers with your 13 cast leading the charge there, you know, becoming stars in their own right these days. And so many students across so many schools that do 13 really taking inspiration from you. Do you hear from a lot of people?
You know, when the licensing for 13 started and schools started doing it, I actually went to a lot of those productions and I would, you know, go around just to see how it was coming and how people were interpreting it and what was going on with that out in the world. And it was, you know, it was beautiful. It was really a wonderful thing to see because, you know, what had been happening before then is I had these youngish fans and they would all be singing Stars in the Moon and Still Hurting. And I'd be like, isn't there something I can do that, you know, is sort of appropriate for the way that they sing and the emotional lives that they actually have right now as opposed to the ones they aspire to? And so that was really my impetus for 13 was to you know, take care of that group of kids. So it's, you know, purely selfishly, the idea that all of these kids are singing my music and you know, take it to heart, you know, really care about it and really love it, that's enormous for me. It's fantastic. And, you know, that couldn't have worked out any better. But, you know, stuff that has nothing to do with me, like Ariana's career, or, you know, the way that, you know, these kids are just sort of exploding into the world. I'm just very proud. I think, wow, you know, they got to express some part of themselves through my work. And how cool is that? You know, I got to, you know, Ariana Grande's first Broadway show was, you know, something I wrote. And I think that must make me pretty cool.
So to wrap things up here, tell us a little bit about what's happened with the last 5 years film.
You know, almost as much as I do, we are waiting now for an American distributor to sign on. We have a couple of offers and we're trying to figure out which way we want to go with it. And I would imagine that we're talking about late summer, early fall for the release of the movie. It is this really exciting, really very different kind of a movie. And, you know, it's just Anna and Jeremy are so amazing. And so, you know, we're all dying to let people hear it and, you know, let people see what we did. So I'm hoping that soon, but I don't have any control over stuff. So, you know, let's hope it works out. And other than that, what can I tell you?
Well, Jason, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us on Broadway Radio. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Have a good day.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Grow old with me. Stay as the days go past. Grow old with me. Some things are meant to last. If you'll agree, heaven might wait. We could delay our expiration date.
Just a note for our listeners, we had audio problems with Peter's mic this week, so we want you to know that it's us, not you. Sorry about that. With us this morning, we have a special guest. Sean McDermott is joining us on a Sunday morning. Sean, we have seen in Broadway productions such as Starlight Express, Miss Saigon, Falsettos in Greece, and he's got something coming up called The Barty Bunch, which we're going to talk about. So, Sean, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, Sean, tell us a little bit about The Barty Bunch. Were you with it as it was at The Fringe?
No, I just joined it. There's a few people that are from The Fringe, but a lot of us are new. It's fun. It's a great show. I know we'll talk about it, but basically The Barty Bunch is the feud, the war between the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family, a la Shakespeare with the great Brady Bunch. And Partridge Family music, I Think I Love You, Sunshine Day. It's a kick. It's very funny.
So that's going to be opening up this week coming up?
This Thursday, March 20th, runs through April 13th. And Thursday through Sundays.
And you're at the theater at St. Clement's?
St. Clement's Theater, yeah.
Well, great. And folks can check it out at thebartybunch.com, thebartybunch.com.
Yeah.
So, Sean, tell us how have you fit this into your schedule of concerts and promotions and various other things that you're doing?
Well, it just worked out perfectly. This time period, I was available and ready to jump in and have fun and play. It's a lot of that. It's a lot of fun. So it worked out by the grace of God. Yeah.
Stephen Garvey, who created the show, told me he was thrilled, you know, when you just walked into the audition. So I was wondering, how did you become aware of it, Sean?
I have a great agent, a great manager. And, you know, as they did, you know, they took a chance with Silence when I went in for that, Silence of the Musical, going up for Hannibal Lecter. I thought never in a million years. And it all just worked out. And yeah, it was the same with this. You know, it just sounded like so much fun, and I thought, well, why not go in? And didn't realize that the creators, the writer, choreographer, and director, you know, knew of me and had seen me in Silence and knew my other work. So it was sort of a great combination for all of us, and a really great team. Love working with them.
Did you watch these series when you were growing up?
Of course, knew all the songs. What was so great, it was funny when we got the material, every song, you know, all the David Cassidy Partridge Family songs, and of course the Silly Brady Bunch songs, you remember, you start singing to them. I was playing for a friend, and she started, you know, sang with every song that, you know, I played for her. So of course, yeah, I knew the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family very well. Worked with Shirley Jones quite a bit, and Florence Henderson out in LA, and here done a lot of concert, you know, benefits work with both of them. Really lovely lady, so that kind of helps with you know, creating character and just knowing how much fun they are. Laurie Hamill is playing Carol Brady. Chrissy Cates is playing Shirley Partridge. I know both of them. They're both beautiful ladies, gorgeous voices, incredible actresses. So I really feel you know, honored, and it's going to be a treat to do this, be part of it.
When the show played at the Fringe initially and I first heard about it, I assumed it was just a Brady Bunch parody,
which it is.
But then, I mean, I didn't realize initially that the Partridges were also in it.
Yeah.
And I also didn't, until I saw it, I didn't get the pun on Bardy.
Yeah, the Bard, Shakespeare. And yeah, Julia, a graduate friend of mine, had kind of tipped me off on that too. I was like, I had known of that, but it was like, realize that this is, you know, the Bard, Shakespeare. I said, oh, of course, that's what that means. And of course, the tag, the War of the Families, Partridge and Brady. And it is, and we do pull, Stephen has pulled quite a bit of references to Shakespeare, and they fit in so perfectly. You know, the character of Danny and the Partridge Family, always, you know, creating trouble or trying to, it just fits so perfectly in the Marcia falling in love with Greg and Greg falling, not Marcia falling in love with Keith and Greg falling in love with Lori and, you know, all the, you know, we've got Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth. You know, Carol and Mike and his boss, you can only imagine what that is. I'm not going to do any spoiler alerts, but there's a lot of, you know, tragedy, you know, comedy, of course, you can't get away from that. And yeah, a lot of blood in the end. It's a real twist on, you know, lots of people. I won't tell you who, but it's fun. Yeah, James, you saw it, so you know.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, what was interesting about Silence, too, is everybody knew the movie. Everybody knew these references. So that's why it was so funny. And it's going to be the same thing with this. Everybody knows the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family. And I heard that the performances were sold out, that they actually had to turn people away. And a couple different celebrities were there, you know, because they do. They love these shows. And, you know, we grew up on them. So it's going to be fun.
Well, it really is quite a hilarious mashup. I remember one of the reviews. I remember specifically. There's of course a Cindy Brady character, and you know, with her little lisp. And at one point, she says, "I am Flain."
Yeah, she does. Well, she quotes Shakespeare and with a lift. I'm not going to give it away. Just have to come and see it. But you can't help. I have moments with her where I just really have to hold it back because you just want to bust out laughing. And, you know, a lot of the show is that way. And,
Florence Henderson has told me that whenever she deals with people interviewing her, she knows she's going to be asked her potential. Well, I don't know about potential, but anyway, her alleged affair with Barry Williams. Did this come up in the show at all?
somebody made a reference to that the other day. It does not. That part.
That's where you draw the line. Okay.
That's what, you know, the funny thing is, or the funny thing, I think what makes it funny and hilarious is we, the way that it has been directed and, written, it's taken very, you know, Jay Stern has directed it in a way that, you know, we're taking it very seriously. We're playing it like, you know, they really did play it, all of these, you know, not really going for the punchlines and the, you know, oh Mike, oh Alice, you know, all of those, oh Danny, you know, with the partridges, you know, all those lines are in there that were in the show, and you know, we're not beating over the head. It really is, you know, taking it seriously, and you know, I think that you know, all the stuff that was around Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family having these major movie stars and stage actors, you know, we're following it just like the series, you know, that were played, which were very serious at the time. And you watch them now and they're, you know, they're just so different from sitcoms these days.
Sean, let's take you back to the opening night of Miss Saigon on Broadway. And you were a young Marine. And tell us about, you know, what that process was like to be part of such a huge opening.
Oh, I can't tell you. It was a dream come true. You know, they say, you know, reach for your dreams. And that was really amazing to be a part of that cast, the original cast with Jonathan Pryce and Lea Salonga and Hinton Battle and Liz Callaway and Nick Heitner directing. And it was such a special, special experience. And now, you know, with Facebook, you get to relive it. You know, one of the first days of rehearsal, you know, somebody took a picture. It's a famous picture that's out there now, you know, because of Facebook. You know, coming into that and just sitting in rehearsal and you know, hearing and watching Lea Salonga and obviously Jonathan Pryce that were so incredible from London recreate these roles, and then seeing Hinton Battle create it for the first time, and Liz Callaway's just glorious angelic voice singing these songs. There were times it was just had to pinch myself that I was part of this, and you know, of course, the opening night and it being so incredible, and then taking over the role and running in it for 3 years and going back into it, and it was just a really special experience. I love being in it. I sat out once and watched Jared Emick, I think, and I love being in the show. It was hard watching. I think it was so great. It was that way with falsettos too. I like being in it more than I appreciate it watching it, you know, because it was such a special experience and a special show. And the music's great. And it's, I hear, being revived in London right now.
Yeah.
I think along with gonna come over here. Along with Lane is, can't wait to see that.
So you mentioned falsettos. And you put that whole Act One and Act Two back together. How did that work out for you?
Well, it was Pete Sanders. Pete is the one that said, I think, Pete, where were we? You remember us? Was it Sam's, the restaurant that used to be? We were over there, and I was in a rehearsal for something, I think you saw me or you called me, and you said, that might have been before cell phones, said, you want to come over and see falsettos? And I came over and saw it. It was still when Michael Rupert was in it and Stephen Bogardus. And I got to be familiar with it. I knew it in college. I had never seen it. I just knew the March of the Falsettos more than I did the Falsetto Land. And soon after that, Stephen Bogardus had left. I went in for an audition. Very funny story. Patrick Cassidy, you know, Shirley Cassidy's son, Patrick Cassidy. Uh-huh. Was up, and it was between the two of us. I worked with him later, and he said, you know, I had something come up and I wasn't able to take that, and you ended up getting that. And he had seen me in Saigon, and we, you know, instantly became friends. But it just worked out. Again, you know, I was at the right place, right? There's so much of this business and careers happened that way, you know, just being at the right place at the right time. And going into that show, it was a very interesting experience. I'd had 2 weeks rehearsal, 1 week with the music, and we were setting up the blocking, and there was so much of it with the modular furniture and the chess scene with Mandy Patinkin was doing it at the time, and then the racquetball scene, and we were going to have to do a lot of work with that, and James Lapine was directing, and it was like, we're going to have to sit down and really work through this. You know, Mandy's very particular, and that night, The understudy who was on at the time, Salviviano, I was nowhere near that backstage, tripped down the stairs, and not that I would have even wanted to be, and had sprained his ankle. And the next day during rehearsal, Mo Gibson came to me, the stage manager at the time, and said, "Sean, they've called us and it's a sprain. He's broken his ankle. Can you go on tonight?" And I, you know, was kind of in shock and said, "Yeah, I'll try." And went home, got my stuff, came back and had 15 minutes with Mandy Patinkin on stage. He came and he said, "What do you want to do, kid?" I said, "I want a chess scene and then back a ball scene." We did. James opined in my dressing room and said, "Well, just do what you can do." That was it. And it went like, it was amazing. It was theater magic. Mandy gave a curtain speech at the end and had one little up with during You Gotta Die Sometime, but Maureen Moore and Heather McRae, they were literally shoving me off stage. "Now take off your pants here, put on your shirt there, run to the other side," because I had none of that, and I was in. And from then on, you know, I mean, that was incredible. That was an amazing experience working with Mandy Patinkin in that cast. Carol Lee Carmello came in at one point, and Jason Graw took over for Chip Zion, and of course, Randy Graff took over for, I think it was Carol Lee, Barb.
Barbara Marino.
Barbara Walsh. I mean, these people just, and actually Jason and Randy were watching that time because they were going to be going in and replacing those characters too. So it was just one of those things. I think your senses take over, it's panic, but you just sort of, you know, something happens and you just do what you have to do. And it was a really fun experience. Singing with Mandy, opposite Mandy, and playing opposite him was another dream come true. It's just been really, really great times.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning. We look Absolutely. Forward to seeing you on the Barty Bunch.
Yes, come and see the show. It's so much fun. And like I said, Thursdays through Sundays, I think Thursday through Saturday is 8 o'clock, and a 7 o'clock show on Sundays. I think ticket prices are $18, so it's inexpensive, a time to have fun and laugh and remember all those good, you know, those funny sitcom moments, and the music is fantastic. And this cast is incredible. These kids, I say kids because I'm playing father now. They have amazing voices. They're so talented, and the dancing and singing is just fun. I love fun.
All right. Well, you can catch up with Sean at SeanMcDermott.com, and information for the Barty Bunch and Sean will be on our website at BroadwayRadio.com. Sean, you have a great day.
You too, guys.
Thank
Great
you.
Talking to you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Mock me with grace. Let me be used. There in my
So moving on to our reviews for this week, the three of us got a chance to see All the Way. So why don't we start off with that, Peter?
All the Way does not refer to the famous song that won an Oscar from the movie The Joker is Wild. All the Way refers to All the Way with LBJ, the slogan that Lyndon Baines Johnson used during his 1964 campaign to win the presidency. Of course, he assumed the presidency in November of 1963 after John Kennedy was assassinated. So here's a man who didn't expect this greatness to be thrust upon him, and he really had to do something with it. And in this show, we see that he really endeavored to do quite a bit. a lot of people may have assumed, just from a knee-jerk reaction, that somebody from Texas, the Solid South, would not be interested in civil rights for Black Americans. But indeed, Lyndon Baines Johnson was, and worked very hard to make that happen. And that's really the crux of the show, that Robert Schenken, who won a Pulitzer Prize for the Kentucky cycle, has endeavored to show. And the struggle is really riveting. We know what's going to happen. I won't say that it's as well written as 1776 and making you really feel all that suspense, but it does bring up the fact that this was a very hard-fought fight, and it a lot of people did not go gently into this. There were plenty of opponents to this, and they were very, 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 very at home with being prejudiced and feeling that this should not happen. So it's kind of shocking today to see that occur. I mean, we certainly expect that from George Wallace, the redneck politician. And by the way, Rob Campbell looks very much like him. Of all the people who look like who they're supposed to look like, this is the most successful. So this is about that struggle mostly, and other things come in too that are quite dynamic. One of the reasons the play exists on Broadway is because Bryan Cranston decided to do it. And what's really wonderful is here's a man who came out of nowhere, became an overnight star thanks to this TV series, Breaking Bad, although Malcolm in the Middle was something he was doing too. But he can have his choice of anything at this moment in time. And I know for a fact he has a movie that he's going to do right after this. But he chose to do a Broadway show. And God love him for doing it. He's magnificent in it. He looks the part, he acts it, he has the ferocity. He certainly has the earthiness for which LBJ was very, very famous. So he's not afraid to use cuss words, as they would say down south. And it's really pretty a really riveting performance. I think everybody in the show is very good. I would have liked to have seen more of John McMartin as Senator Richard Russell, but nevertheless, what he does is choice. Michael McKean is almost unrecognizable as J. Edgar Hoover. He's pretty terrific, too. And there is some subtle digs at J. Edgar Hoover's private life that we've since learned about. So so it's Bill Rausch, who heads the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and has done wonderful work up there that I've seen, has directed very seamlessly, and it's really nice to see so many young people coming to the theater to see Bryan Cranston and coming away learning something about history of 50 years ago that we very much have taken for granted now. But nevertheless, to see that this was such a hard-fought fight and there were so many obstacles in the way, and yet it happened, and it happened because of the single-mindedness of LBJ, who was very, very reluctant to compromise and made very few compromises along the way to see this happen. So I think it's a terrific show, and what a great debut for Bryan Cranston, who I dare say will get nominated for a Tony, and it's not impossible he could win.
All right.
If only because nobody wants to hear what Mark Rylance is going to do this time when he gives a Tony acceptance.
Well, you know, Denzel's on the periphery, so...
Well, I suppose that's true. Yes, you've got a good point there.
Denzel is a favorite among the Tony voters, so, we have yet to see what he has done, but I'm just going to throw it out there that I'm assuming he's going to get a Tony nomination. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about All the Way?
Well, first of all, it's worth noting that not only did Bryan Cranston choose to do Broadway rather than some other high-profile movie or whatever, but he chose to do a play that started at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. It was a co-production there of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and ART. And of course, you know, I mean, I'm sure they had every intention to bring it to Broadway, but nothing is guaranteed. I think that's great that he did that. And he is fantastic in it, as Peter said. It's a very long play. It's just under 3 hours. For me, I think it definitely could have been edited without suffering greatly at all. It seemed like some of the beats were being repeated over and over. I never saw the Kentucky Cycle, which actually did not run that long on Broadway.
No, I'm afraid it didn't.
Even though it did win a Pulitzer. It won a Pulitzer and the Tony. But I did feel that there was a lot of expositional dialogue in this that is in the way that people would never actually speak in real life. And although I, of course, I completely realize why it was there, that did bother me quite a bit. Then there were other moments that were not like that and just seemed very natural and very dramatic. So I think if the editing had been done on some of the historical background or if Schenken had figured out a way to communicate it without making it sound so clunky, that would have been great. But the story is so compelling, the overall story. I noticed a marked similarity to the film Lincoln. Did you both see that?
Yeah, that's fair. Right, sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. In that case, it was obviously the Emancipation Proclamation and the amendment, whichever amendment that was to free the slaves. But in this case, it's quite similar because it's civil rights, and just the idea of compromising. In this case, they give up. They decide they have to give up voting rights. Specifically in order to get this to get civil rights legislation passed. And that's interesting because in Lincoln, there were so many compromises that we hear about and see. And then there's also the parallel to 1776. And again, it's the same subject. They feel they have to give up, strike out that line in the Declaration about freeing the slaves, because if they don't, then the South won't vote for the Declaration, and then they'll have no America. So isn't it fascinating to see that the through line there from 1776 to Lincoln and then to LBJ and all over, African Americans and civil rights? Really kind of amazing how that issue has dominated this country for hundreds of years, and I often think, it's such a blot on this country. Can you imagine what would this country be like if we had never had slaves? It would be different in so many indeed ways. And I'm sure most all of them far better. Presumably some of those people would have come here anyway, but of their own free will and not in chains. That always fascinates me. I think maybe somebody should write one of those alternate universe plays.
Films sure,
about
sure.
that. That would be a great play or movie.
I wonder if Harry Turtledove has done that. He does a lot of those many of them are fascinating, but I don't know that he's tackled that subject. That is a good question. By any chance, have you ever seen the Oscar-winning short subject from 1936, 1937, somewhere around there, called Declaration of Independence? Anyway, at one point they say, there's going to be trouble with that slavery clause. And Jefferson says, okay, let's take it out. It's boom. It's accomplished in one line, which is quite different from 1776. So that's something worth seeing. Turner Classic Movie shows it from time to time. Keep an eye out for it. It really makes Caesar Rodney the big hero of the from Delaware rather than John Adams. So it's worth a look. Keep an eye out for it on TCM.
Well, but absolutely, in 1776, it's probably the most dramatic moment in the entire show. And I actually don't know. I may have researched it. I don't know completely how accurate it is, but I think I think there's a fair amount of accuracy there. It's just interesting to me. Two other people I want to single out in all the way, and I absolutely agree with Peter about Rob Campbell, and the friend who I brought also said, God, he really looks like George Wallace, at least the way he's made up in this play. But also, I want to single out Brandon Dearden for a really wonderful performance as Martin Luther King, and in that case, not looking especially like him, but just really, really. A really moving and natural performance. Makes him a human being, not a god on the one hand, and not filled with all these horrible flaws on the other. And I'm really glad to see a portrayal of Martin Luther King like that on Broadway, because I really, really did not like The Mountaintop, as we've discussed before. So it's good to see him get his due as a dramatic character in this play. And the other person I want to single out is Robert Petkoff, who looks somewhat like Hubert Humphrey, I would say younger and more handsome. But I noticed, did you notice, it seemed like he really got Humphrey's speech patterns down. He really sounded, as soon as he started talking, I was like, yeah, that's kind of what Humphrey sounded like. And that role, I think, is also very well written in this play. So I think he came across very well. And my hat's off to him, to use Peter's phrase. I think he really did an excellent job.
So I saw it as well. I think the same night Michael saw it, and yes. I really enjoyed it. I think I mentioned to Peter, not to Michael, that it was a very long day for me, and so to end up the evening with a 3-hour play was problematic for me, because the first act dragged, and I wasn't sure if the first act was dragging for me because it was dragging or because I was really tired. But the second act, I thought, it's unbelievable. And not that the first act wasn't good. It was just, it seemed long to me. I thought the play was very ambitious to get so much detail and layers into it. And one of the things that my wife and I had discussed was that we weren't sure if everything was, if anything was dramatized, or were the facts accurate. What was your take on that? On most of this stuff, I thought that maybe sometimes when they dramatize stuff, they compress the time frame to make it more dramatic. But it didn't seem like it seemed to me, and I'm not a student of this time period, that everything was accurate. Did you feel that everything was historical?
Well, I don't know for sure, but we do know that the time frame for the election is accurate. So in that sense, the overall time frame, I certainly haven't done enough research to know exactly how accurate it is, but it felt accurate, you know.
And that.
All right, I'll address this issue. I felt I was around in 64, and it seemed to me that there was far less doubt that Johnson would be reelected from the polls. And that doesn't come up at all here. It seems like he's really on the ropes. And there is some dialogue about Louisiana has him 10 points behind, that type of thing. But my recollection at the time was that the polls were saying that he was going to win and win in a walk, which indeed he did. That was something that I found a little too convenient for the play, and didn't strike me as historically accurate. I could be wrong about that, but I'm just saying at the time it seemed to me, and it may be because I was living in Massachusetts and a very liberal state and a state that wanted the Democrat to win, that was the case. But nevertheless, that was something I did question historically.
I have a rather chilling memory because I was quite young, and I remember, you know, I mean, they were just names to me, but I knew it was Johnson and I knew it was Goldwater. And I remember like someone my age, which was, so what was it, 1964?
Yeah.
So I was like 7. And I remember some kids saying to me something like, oh, well, Goldwater is the better one. You know, we were talking politics at 7, you know, and I was like, why? And he said, do you want to go to school with black children?
Wow.
So that's my chilling memory.
Well, you know, it's a the other thing that I was marveling at was Bryan Cranston, his portrayal of LBJ and the way in which LBJ had to appease both sides, his conservatives and his Democrat and Republican friends, and it seemed as though the more of that should be needed today. It was also very interesting, some of the very liberal jabs that were thrown in the play. And, you know, for the record, I'm a very big liberal. We pretty much don't discuss politics on here, but I'm not saying that the liberal jabs, I disagreed with them, but I wonder how that plays in other audiences. You know, the blaming of Vietnam on McNamara and Herbert, There was another big jab thrown in.
Well, there was, but there's also the lines that in retrospect people chuckle at. Wasn't there a line where somebody says the Republican Party will never take the South?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
That got a laugh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, J. Edgar Hoover, the J. Edgar Hoover, the gay jokes, they were very, very insightful and funny. Yeah, yeah. Subtle, but the audience really got them.
Oh yeah.
The audience really. So I really enjoyed this. I can't recommend it enough. And I don't know if it is historically accurate, but if it is historically accurate, I encourage students to get out there and see this. It was very, very good.
But if you're a student group, be careful what you eat beforehand.
Yes. Did you hear about that? The
Students, is that what you mean?
Yeah, students from Virginia that were sick in Times Square. What do they have? They have some flu, or
they think they may have. I don't know if it's been determined that they may have that norovirus.
Yes,
and they all got sick during a performance of Phantom of the Opera, and I think they're not sure if they all ate at the same restaurant in Manhattan, or if they brought it West Virginia.
Virginia.
Because apparently there was an outbreak of it down there. So I guess more will be found out soon.
All right. So let's move forward. Peter got a chance to see Anthony and Cleopatra. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I'm afraid this is a show that isn't going over at all. It's been adapted. That's too strong a word, because it is Shakespeare's language, and I imagine there have been cuts, but Talbot Alvin McCraney, who's an astonishing young playwright, decided to tackle Anthony Patrick, and what he's done is basically set it in the Caribbean. At least it seems that way. And while you have Caucasian actors playing the Romans, and you have black actors playing the Egyptians, it still feels like the Caribbean. And certainly the music that's behind it is one reason why. And one reason is why this has to be. The idea of having black actors playing Egyptians is a good idea, because after all, Egypt is in Africa. So so that was okay with me. But I don't know why setting it in the Caribbean meant anything. So that confused me. Nevertheless, I have to say that this was terribly unattended. There were so few people in the audience to begin with, and I'm sorry to say that there were far fewer after intermission, and that was discouraging. Literally, six people next to me in my row were all gone at intermission. So this is obviously not a popular success, and that's too bad, because some of it really catches fire. Jonathan Cake is especially good as Antony, because in his scenes with Cleopatra, boy, does he make them crackle. I mean, these are real arguments with a lot at stake, and I'm telling you, he really rips into it. In a way, he's able to show how much is at stake, but also it seems to be the type of arguments that lovers have. I don't mean over issues involving love, but just the idea when people are used to each other, that they've lived with each other for some time, they fight in a very ferocious way, and he got that, and that was something that I really appreciated. I wish Joaquina Calacanga was a little better as Cleopatra. She seemed very one note to me, so I didn't much like that at all. It's a long evening. It's 2:45, and it feels it. I'm sorry to say, but there is a stay with it, though, because there is a nice surprise in the way that Cleopatra dies. You have an image in your head about Cleo clutched her ass, to quote a Carolyn Lee lyric, but it's a little different here, and that's worth seeing. But, you know, this is at the Anspacher Theater, which is a thrust stage theater. So people are on three sides. And the danger with that type of theater is always that you can see see what people are thinking, because you see their expressions on their faces, especially because this is a very well-lit production. I'm telling you, the lights are bright in this one. So you can see what your fellow theatergoers are thinking, the expressions on their faces. And the people who stayed during the second act, I was starting to think that they were very jealous of the people who had left at intermission. So my advice, by the way, if you go, and at intermission you're on the fence about staying, and you decide to stay, and then you regret it 5 minutes into the second act, well, it's not long after that there's a scene where Jonathan Cake and Joaquin Calicando make love. And as a result, they want to be very private about it, so Jonathan Cake pulls a tarpaulin over both of them. So they're both covered. They're the only actors on stage. They won't see you go if you leave. So as a result, that's a good time to take your leave if you decide to. And you may very well. So it's plodding. At times, it seems like business like usual. When Jonathan Cake is not on stage, he really works very hard to make it come alive and almost succeeds in making the whole thing come alive.
Well, Peter, I have never seen a production of that play, and I don't even know. I mean, I suppose I must have read it at some point. Is it my impression is that it's really considered one of his far lesser works. And do you think that there are significant problems in the play itself, and that's why we hardly ever see it?
You know, it's funny you say that, because scholars have a tough time in even categorizing it, you know, because it isn't quite history. Mm. And it is quite a tragedy in many respects. But a lot of people say it should be in the romance faction of the canon. But yeah, it's one of those plays you expect to be better than it is, because you have these two famous characters. And who knows? Maybe when it was first produced, it turned out to be as disappointing as the Cleopatra movie in 1963 with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. It plods along. There were a few subplots that drive you crazy, stuff involving the triumvirate. Some of it is very melodramatic, in the sense that Antony is encouraged to marry somebody else, and that, of course, doesn't make Cleopatra happy at all, needless to say, because she thought they were getting along very well. But nevertheless, politics demands that he make this union to help matters politically. So, yeah, it might very well be. It certainly doesn't seem like one of Shakespeare's great plays. I've seen it quite a few times. I've seen it in Oregon. I've seen it in Alabama. I've seen it in New Jersey with Bob Cuccioli playing Antony in a very good production.
Oh, right.
But this one doesn't add up. It really seems slow and plodding. However, you know, you got to give McCraney credit for wanting to tackle something completely different. And he's directed it as well. It's not just that he's edited, he's directed it as well. And while this isn't a tremendous success, the fact remains, one has to give this young tremendous credit for doing something off the beaten path.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the film with Taylor and Burton. And then there's also the Shaw version of Caesar and Cleopatra, which I think is also really not considered one of his best. I mean, it seems like there's something about the story that kind of maybe resists dramatization. One would think otherwise, you know. It's interesting.
If you think Caesar and Cleopatra is bad,
yes.
What about the musical version called Per First Roman, which lasted 17 performances in 1968? You haven't. I went to a backers audition of that, and I consider it my theatrical bar mitzvah, because everybody was having such a glorious time while I was sitting there saying these songs were all wrong for these characters. I mean, they were nightclub songs, it was so bizarre to me. And there I was, a very young man, and everybody else was smiling and having a wonderful time, and everybody joined in one of the songs in which Caesar was singing, "I fell in with evil companions and I had the time of my life." Would you expect that in a Shavian work? Rollicking song, and I had the springtime for Hitler look on my face while all this was happening. And it's really fun, because that song is totally out of character and totally wrong for the show. And I will never forget this. It's played Boston. I saw it. I couldn't believe how bad it was. And then I happened to be in New York, the first New York preview, so let me see how what work they've done. They dropped the song, and you know, the act was duller without it. I missed the damn thing. I mean, it was just so bizarre. Anyway, yeah, maybe it is a problem between, maybe Cleopatra's story isn't as dramatic as we think. I guess it is, should be, though, but I guess we're still waiting for somebody to do it right. So if any listener out there is looking for a project, here's your chance to redeem the Cleopatra story.
Yes.
All right. Michael and Peter got a chance to see Open House. Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, this is one of those plays where you really want to talk about it, but you can't because the spoilers are, or I guess one huge, tremendous spoiler, arises. And I don't think that anyone would want to know what that spoiler is before seeing the play. And it continues, it's been extended, the production at the Signature, through March 30th. So what I will say, and then I'll see what Peter feels comfortable saying, is that it starts out a very realistic living room set of a home, and the family is there. I guess the slightly extended family. You have the mother and father, the two adult children, and an uncle. And as I say, the setting is completely realistic. But then the things these people start saying to each other, you're like, what is going on? And specifically, the father, played by Peter Friedman, played very, very well. To perfection, I would say, by Peter Friedman, keeps saying these horrible things, like these snarky little remarks to everyone, and just really, really hateful stuff, and you're not sure what is going on. It's very funny in a very dark way. The audience was really with it in terms of laughter at the performance I attended, but then about halfway through, something happens, mm-hmm. and everything is turned on its head, and that's where I guess I have to stop talking.
So, okay, Peter,
well,
can you expand?
Well, sure. It is a little, it's a very smart play in the sense that it shows the difficulties of when a family must get together for a certain occasion. In this case, it's an anniversary. And when a family doesn't get along and there are real problems there, what can you do? You have to show up for the anniversary. You have to pretend that you're glad to be there. And that's all there is to it. And that's why the kids are there. Otherwise, they have no interest in being there because they know that their mother is a little ditzy and their father, wow. I mean, he, curmudgeon is a very a modest way of putting it. I mean, this is almost a psychopath. And that's part of the story, the fact that Willino definitely wanted to show a dysfunctional family and indicate that there's plenty of this going on in America. And it's a very difficult circumstance that many families face when they have to get together. So, ironically enough, in the middle of the play, it takes a completely different turn. It's almost like two one-act plays, and that's what Michael's alluding to. But I will say this: one of the things that it does point out, I know this sounds like a non sequitur, but the play goes into a non sequitur, is how difficult it is to deal with real estate people. I'm telling you. I mean, they are just voracious. They have to be. I mean, they have to pretend to be pleasant. They have to pretend that everything's lovely when they show a home, that type of thing. And it really does get into that quite a bit. You will see everybody in the family show up one more time in very different circumstances. I know I'm being oblique, as Michael wanted to be as well. But it does take a very strange turn. And a lot of people are not going to be satisfied because it's going to be a case where they want to stick with that family and they want to know what's going to happen to that family. But in essence, what Willino is saying is that eventually the days end with anniversaries come to an end and people go home. People leave in this play for very different reasons and a little more abruptly than they might without conflagrations. I mean, that's what's interesting. This never erupts into a full-blown fight, which you might expect it would. However, it doesn't, and that's realistic too, because everybody wants to keep the peace, even though, as Michael says, that father is so insulting. He is so to take. But again, it's an anniversary. You're not going to fan the flames. You're going to be very nice as much as you can, no matter how many times you're insulted. And Peter Friedman works hard at that, the character anyway, in trying to insult. So, and one of the things, you know, Michael mentioned the realistic set. Yes, it's the type of set you've seen a million times, and that's part of it too. I mean, it wants to represent the average American home. There's nothing extraordinary about the set. There shouldn't be. It's a perfectly nice living room, you know, with the staircase going up in the back, you know, that type of thing. And when you go in there, it is such a quintessential house set that you know that something difference is going to be played on it, because the set is purposely a cliche. So and Willino definitely plays against that to indicate the typical American family does have its problems, and you can pretend they don't exist, but oh, they do. And especially Peter Friedman's character, we should say, has obviously suffered some sort of stroke or something like that, because he's in a wheelchair, he's got the blanket over his knees, that type of thing. So he's at the point in his life where he doesn't care anymore what he's saying. He knows that he doesn't have all that long to live, and as a result, to make the most of it and say what's on his mind and what he's been keeping from these people, we infer anyway, that he's been keeping from them all along the way. So Willino is definitely a maverick playwright, and I'm really looking forward to the Realistic Joneses, his play that's going to be on Broadway it's in previews now, but it's going to be opening shortly. And I am really looking forward to that, because this is a playwright that many people love, many people hate, but it's what really creates reactions, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what my reaction will be to the next one.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you say that. This the open house was the first Willino play that I've seen, and as odd as it is, especially after the twist happens, after the show was over and the curtain call and the lights came up, I sort of turned to the lady in back of me, and we sort of, you know, made eye contact,
right.
She said, she said, "Have you seen his previous plays?" And I said, "No, actually." And she said, "This one is far more accessible than any one of those." And that struck me as interesting. But also, it sounds like, from what little I've read about the Realistic Joneses, it sounds like there might be some similar themes in that one to this one. So that would be interesting to see. And it is that this will be Willino's Broadway debut, The Realistic Joneses. So that's going to be, a red letter event in that sense.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, you got out to see a production of Anyone Can Whistle. Can you tell us about that?
I really want to, because Anyone Can Whistle is an MTI show, Music Theater International, and I do a column for them every Friday. And I thought, okay, let's see, let's go to this high school in Westfield, New Jersey, and see what they're doing. One thing, it's so bizarre that a high school would be doing Anyone Can Whistle. But it would be something to write about, so good. I was flabbergasted at how magnificent it was, especially because the voices were so great. You know, the thing is, we're used to that original cast album, and, you know, Angela Lansbury was the first show. Her voice really developed as time went on. She's a little shaky in Anyone Can Whistle. Remick has a pleasant voice, no question about it. Harry Gaudino was terrible. So to hear these songs sung beautifully, certainly by two girls who could easily play Elf of Tomorrow, I mean, it was just amazing to hear the clarity of these songs. And I was so impressed with the direction by Daniel Devlin, who made it slick as can possibly be. What's so wonderful, too, is that apparently this Westfield High School and Daniel Devlin have a tremendous reputation. There was an auditorium of about 2,000 seats. It was virtually filled. And even though Anyone Can Whistle is a difficult show, yes, two people behind me left the moment that the big number simple was over, which is a very tough number to take. And while, yes, a few people did not come back after intermission, this was definitely an audience that appreciated the fact that this guy can really put on a high school musical to make it look professional. And it was so amazing to hear people roar with approval after every song because the kids were so magnificent. And that's what they concentrated on. I insisted on talking to kids afterwards, saying how terrific they were. And I also told them to be very gentle when dealing with parents, relatives, and friends when explaining what this was about. You know, it's really, this is a very complicated musical. And yet, I was reminded that in Assassins, there's that famous line when John Wilkes Booth is convincing Lee Harvey Oswald to kill the president. 50 years from now, they'll still be arguing about the grassy knoll, the Cuban, you know, whatever that line is. It's so interesting. Who would have thought 50 years ago, when anyone could whistle closed after 9 performances, that a half century later, a high school would be putting it on and doing it proud? So my hat is off, to use that expression that Michael likes that I use. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'd wear one, but anyway, my hat's always off. I haven't worn a hat since my mother made me wear one of the earlaps. But anyway, my compliments to the chefs out at Westfield, New Jersey, for choosing the show. Beautifully designed, slick as a whistle, no pun intended. I won't be surprised if we hear from these kids as time goes on. So and so wonderful to see many boys up there throwing themselves into the parts of the mayor's assistants, her cabinet, so to speak. And they really, really were good. So I'm so glad I went. And frankly, if I didn't have a party that I had to go to last night, a birthday party, I would have gone back again. And I mean that.
Well, that's a really impressive achievement, because my feeling about that show is that I always thought it was – I always thought it just did not work.
It doesn't.
Well, but, you know, but I mean, the original production was a huge flop. Mm-hmm. Then I saw that concert that they did, the one-nighter benefit with Bernie Peters and Scott Bakula, and, you know, and I thought, oh, this really does not work. And I had – pretty much written the show off. And then I saw the Encores one and I loved it. And I think in that case, that it's the basic reason why it worked is that Casey Nicholaw just really knew what he was doing, and they really stressed the humor of it rather than trying to be really heavy-handed with the satire and the you know, and the dark stuff. So maybe that's what these kids did and their director, because to me it was like a different show, Peter.
Well, to be fair, it may very well be the case that you're getting used to it too. That you know, it was about the third time you were seeing it, or the second, anyway. You know, so that might even help as well. It is a show that really helps the more you see it, understand what's going on. I think if Arthur Lawrence had it to do over again, he might have been very wise. There's all this talk about the cookies in the cookie jar. I think he would have been much better off using the expression nuts in a nut house. I mean, that would have at least made clear that we're dealing. It takes a long time for people to realize that cookies and cookie jars mean crazy people and asylum. It's just too hard. The optimism, I think, really hurts the show. That may sound bizarre, but I came to that conclusion while watching this the other night.
Because, and not only that, but I always felt that expression. It's so twee.
It is twee, isn't it? Yeah,
it's just like it sounds like it's childish. The cookies and the cookie jar.
Yes,
you know.
Yes, indeed.
I guess nuts does too, but we all know what that means.
Means. At least it's clear. And boy, if there's one thing that anyone commercial needs, it's as much clarity as it can possibly get. It really does, you know. So it's really something. So, and yet, I'll never forget that season. I started reading Variety that season. Variety used to give a summary after each show opened, saying this show opened to there were seven papers at the beginning of the season, and in October one paper folded. But nevertheless, they would say it opened to six bands, you know, a show like Once for the Asking, which lasted one night, or Six Raves. Barefoot in the Park, Six Raves, six qualified approvals, that type of thing. Anyone Can Whistle open to three raves and three pans. I mean, that was really interesting. I'd never seen anything like that, because there was no unanimity. I mean, and it's one thing if a show gets lackluster reviews from everybody, okay, you know, but to have at disparity, three raves and three pans. And unfortunately for Whistle, the three pans were from the most important papers, certainly from the Times and the Trib, especially, because those were the ones who really sold tickets in those days. So that's why opened on Saturday and closed on Saturday. There was one Tony broadcast some years ago which referenced the Anywhere Could Whistle, and it mentioned that famous line by George S. Kaufman, satire closes on Saturday night. And indeed, Anywhere Could Whistle closed on the first Saturday after it had opened. So it certainly adhered to that formula. So, but boy, you know, that cast album is really terrific, no question about it. I'm one of the few who prefer that concert version, I think, because the voices are better. Madeline Kahn, Bernadette Peters, and Scott Bakula are better vocalists, but nobody agrees with me on that any more than they agree with me that the second Pendulum recording is better. We have a big argument on this on Facebook this week. But nevertheless, the Whistle concert is my album choice. So, give it a try. Try listening to that and see if you agree with me. I won't be surprised if you don't. I won't be surprised if you do.
All right. So let's move forward. Michael got a chance to see Nothing But Trash at Theater for the New City. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Well, this was written by Andy Halliday, who has been a mainstay of many of Charles Bush's genre spoofs in the past. And he wrote this one, and he's also in it. And I guess I had very mixed feelings about it. I think overall he did a very good job in the writing, other than a couple of plot points that really didn't make sense to me. This play is pretty much a spoof of movies like A Summer Place and maybe a little Peyton Place and movies with like troubled teenagers from the like late 50s or early 60s. And that's the specific target here, which is one that I don't think Charles Bush has ever done. So I suppose maybe that's why Andy picked this one. So as I said, I think the writing overall was very good and shows a lot of talent despite the few plot errors that he made, and I wish he would like go over and maybe review those because I don't think it would take a lot to fix them. But I think it was a combination of the direction by G.R. Johnson and also Andy's performance. The pacing was way off. It seemed like cues were not picked up by Andy and maybe some of the other actors, and that just really damaged it, because this kind of comedy has to be played, you know, in really in a certain way, and there's not a lot of room for Pinter-esque pauses for sure. I don't know if some of them were because of the lines were not got down cold. It was early in the run, so maybe that might be part of it. But maybe that will get better as it goes on. I'd actually like to see this production again closer to the final performance, and I would expect it that might improve greatly. But overall, very clever and some really amazing talents in it, most of whom have not, I would not say are very high profile, but I have to single out Rory Max Kaplan and Tim McGarrigle as Troy and Tab. These are the two essential characters. And the main twist here, as you probably won't be surprised to hear, is that it's a gay love story between these two young men in the either late 50s or early 60s. So, you know, it's kind of how that would play out, because that's certainly one story we never really saw, at least not overtly in any of those movies, although many people feel that in Rebel Without a Cause, the relationship between the Sal Mineo character and the James Dean character, there's a lot of that in there. So really, these two guys, they're both great and very sincere and both really charismatic and attractive on stage. I think Rory Max Kaplan, he's done like mostly cruise ships and you know, regional theater. Let's see, he's done Chicago and Joseph at the Muni, Jesus Christ Superstar at the Pittsburgh CLO, things like that. But he, I don't, it just seems to me like he could really be a TV or movie star in a minute, in terms of looks and acting ability and charisma, and just really, really a star in the making.
What a wonderful endorsement. That's terrific.
Well, you know, you see, it's great when you, and I'm sure it's happened many, many times to you, Peter. And obviously you're not, you know, it's not going to be on Broadway, because by the time you see someone on Broadway, they're already, you know, pretty far along, in most cases. But if you go down to, this is being done at the Theater for the New City, way down on First Avenue and 10th Street, and I've seen some very creative things there. And here is here are these several people. It's not just him. I don't want to. And also Andrew Glasick, who's done a few shows off Broadway, and this other guy I'd never heard of called David Arrigo Jr. All really, really fantastic. And Rory Max Kaplan, you heard it here first. I think he's going to be a star. I really do.
Well, it's very interesting. Trader News still crops up. I mean, I dare say his name has been mentioned more in musicals than any other person. He's been mentioned 12,000 times on Broadway, at least, because, of course, he shows up in Chorus Line. If Troy Donahue can be a movie star, then I can be a movie star. And, of course, he's also mentioned in Grease.
Salminio is also mentioned in Grease.
Sure, you know, so, you know, it's really something how Troy Donahue, who didn't have that great a career when you think of it, still became poster child for the good-looking guy who made a lot of teenage girls swoon over the years, and I'm sure a lot of teenage boys, too. So but he will always live as long as Grease and Chorus Line are done, and do get done, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So before we wrap up this week, I wanted to say that I think it was last week or maybe the week before I misspoke. Drew Johnson, one of our listeners, pointed it out to me. We were talking about the Les Mis production in North Carolina with Lauren Kennedy. And it was at North Carolina Theater. But Lauren Kennedy's theater that she started is called Theater Raleigh. So it's not. She was in, she and everybody else that she put together this production at North Carolina Theater. It wasn't, she didn't produce it. It was part of the North Carolina Theater's production, which is separate than Theater Raleigh. And details always elude me. So hopefully this is all good. All right. So anything else you guys want to throw in this week before we wrap up?
I'm looking forward to seeing Rocky.
Yeah, Rocky.
Yes, me too. I'm going on Wednesday, and I'm sure we'll talk about that next week. Oh, did I mention this? I think I did. I'm really looking forward to, there's going to be a production of Beyond Therapy, the Christopher Durang play, which I think is, I would say it's the best and funniest thing he ever wrote, even including Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. It had a very brief run on Broadway, despite Diane Wiest and John Lithgow in the leads and David Hyde Pierce, a very young David Hyde Pierce in a supporting role. It's hysterical, and it's being done at Theater Row. So, check it out if you can get there. Theater Row is, I'm happy to say, a place where the ticket prices are not going to be prohibitive necessarily. I think this is really, and of course, I have no idea, you know, about the quality of the production because I haven't seen it yet. But I would really chance it because that play is a scream.
Well, also, the company doing it, TACT, is really a tremendous...
Oh, yes, thank you for saying that. Yes, they have an excellent track record.
Oh, good. However, if you're not in New York and you cannot get to this play, there's an excellent recording of it. Bruce Kimmel did a recording some years ago, and it really is a terrific recording of the play. And unlike the Columbia recordings of the 60s, where they used to try to replicate the sound on stage, Bruce has everybody nice and close to the microphone, so it really sounds like a radio broadcast. So I recommend that recording highly if you can't get to see the show.
Was that, I sort of remember that, was that is that part of that series where they record things in L.A.?
No, this was definitely a separate thing. I know what you're talking about. There is that. Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think this is Bruce got people in the studio and decided to record it because he liked the play.
Wow, that's amazing.
I think so. I think so. I could be wrong about that. You know, just as I was with James, by the way. I assumed that Lauren Kennedy did it in a theater. You know, I may be making an assumption here that's wrong. But what is correct is the fact that this recording exists and it's well worth hearing.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us in iTunes. There are many applications. One of them is Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and it will automatically stream to your device so that you don't have to download and sync it. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as some links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
What more can I say? How am I to face tomorrow after being screwed out of today? Tell me what's in store. Yes, I beg or steal or borrow. If I could hold you for 1 hour more, 1 hour more, 1 hour more, 1 hour, 1 hour more. What would I do if I had not seen you? Who would I feast my eyes on? Once I was told that good men get better with age. We're just gonna skip that stage. There are no answers, but what would I do if you had not been my friend? No simple answers, but what would I do if you had not been my friend, my friend?